the lack of time can be seen as a positive in a way, because the way that like young people and the way that culture moves is at a blistering pace. In a way, it's a challenge, but the flip side is it allows us to work with brands as the world is changing and happening in really smart ways that honestly keeps brands relevant.
What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Nick Soucy, head of strategy from Complex Collective, based in New York, but currently in Jerusalem. Nick, what's up? How are you?
What's up, Mark? Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about how strategy works, and in brackets, whether strategy works in media, because you are part of Complex, which is part of a massive publishing organization, Hearst. What is Complex? Let's start there.
Complex started originally as a magazine that was mostly focused on hip hop and sneakers, started by Mark Echo. I mean, now obviously hip hop and sneakers are very much a part of mainstream pop culture, but at the time that was kind of a very novel thing to do, much more niche kind of culture. But since then, in its success, the company has absolutely exploded and become a very large scale media brand and entertainment brand, where we're not just only creating content for social media or on the .com, but we're doing TV shows, we're doing large scale festivals, we have an e-commerce business. We're kind of spreading the tentacles into a lot of different areas now too.
Okay. Now, you're head of strategy of Complex Collective. What's Complex Collective relative to Complex?
So Complex Collective is our insights and research engine and arm of the company. If you imagine, it's a hose that we're basically plugging into our own brand initiatives, but also our clients' brand initiatives as well.
All right. And then Hearst, massive company. I can see the building. As soon as I think of the name, I can see the building.
Yeah. Complex is actually jointly owned by Hearst and Verizon. So, you know, Verizon's a big telecom company, and with Hearst, it's a big kind of publishing conglomerate. There's a lot of different media companies, publishers that all fall under that big owner. But, you know, Complex in a lot of ways operates fairly independently in how it functions for itself and all of these different arms that kind of extend out from it.
Okay. So on to the question, how does strategy work in media? What is strategy in the function that you and your teams operate in? You know, basically, what do you do?
Strategy in the media world oftentimes is pre-sale strategy or more of an integrated marketing role. That's certainly still a part of what the team does now, but it's certainly evolved from there. So giving a bit of historical context, you know, strategy within a media company is often the department's fielding briefs from media agencies, direct brand clients, sometimes creative agencies. And they're fielding these briefs. They're, you know, understanding what the brand's goals and needs are. They're doing a lot of what a agency would do and crafting how do we respond to this brief. But one of the biggest differences is the timelines look vastly different from that of an agency. I would say the majority of turnaround times on these briefs are anywhere between 24 and 72 hours on a good day. If we're lucky, maybe we have a week or two to respond, but it's super fast paced. So what that means is you're kind of having to almost cut a lot of corners or finding efficiencies. And how do you kind of jam the whole process of research, strategy, creative, the pitch, you know, all into a very tight time frame? So with strategy, oftentimes you're wearing a lot of different hats that in an agency is often kind of broke up into different roles or different teams. So it's a pretty hybrid role. It's not just strategy. It's often strategy and creative combined. And I think as it relates to strategy in a more traditional sense, oftentimes the things that end up having to get cut out or find workarounds is actual, you know, research and the strategy piece versus more of the creative and tactical bits.
So obviously there are a lot of strategy roles in a lot of different companies right now, more than ever. More strategy roles and more types of company than ever right now. But when I speak to people who I've moved into a media agency, often they can be, especially if they've worked in an agency where strategy or account planning was pretty much like a leading role. It wasn't a back office role where you're just churning out documents. Sometimes there's a bit of a culture shock that they're immediately sat behind a sales team who's the alpha, and that the editorial team looks at them with suspicion, and there can be a bit of an adjustment phase. Do you identify with that, or how are the dynamics within Complex and your team?
Yeah, I definitely identify with that. I think historically speaking, when I think back several years, I think that was a much bigger challenge or kind of culture shock than it is now. You're talking about sales and you're talking about the editorial team. So to break that down, starting with sales. So the strategy team still is a function of the sales team. Part of our primary function is, you know, to drive revenue. We're fielding briefs from these brands and agencies. We're trying to concept, you know, how does Complex as a brand work with these other brands? What does that perfect marriage look like? And sometimes that's a range of just doing entirely custom white label work for the brand. Sometimes that is a perfect marriage between our brand and another brand. Sometimes it's more light touch of the other client's brand versus, you know, just straight up sponsoring content that we're already creating for ourselves. But I think as strategy has grown and evolved, you know, the function of strategy within a media company has, it can plug into a lot of different areas that goes well beyond being a function of sales. So I mentioned before, media companies, Complex included, getting into large scale events like merchant e-commerce. There's a lot of different business lines and functions that are extending out of media companies that, you know, selfishly as a strategist and managing a strategy team, it creates a lot of really exciting opportunities to kind of stretch your brain into a lot of different challenges and think about, you know, how am I creatively solving problems that relate to a lot of different areas. And then editorially speaking, you know, I think in the past, I've seen it within Complex, I've seen it within other media companies. There's often this separation of church and state between, you know, you've got the brand business side and you've got, you know, the cool creative editorial folks that are really driving what does the content and the brand look like, you know, for the media company's brand. But honestly, over the past several years, I've seen that wall crumble in a lot of positive ways and through a lot of effort on both sides to trying to find the way of really bringing both sides together. And I think now, especially within Complex, it's a much more synergistic approach where there's so much to be offered and gleaned from both sides to learn from each other's work and how that, you know, informs both the strategy and the creative.
Okay. Now, when strategy sits in a kind of pre-sales function, and honestly, people have approached me about these roles over the years, and they're not always upfront that strategy is part of a pre-sales function. And they're sort of, they draw you in thinking or allowing you to think that you're going to be doing similar work to what you might have done before, but it is different. In some sales groups, thinking gets in the way of the sale. Thinking takes too much time. Thinking is annoying. Just give me the deck. I'll go sell it. I might not give you too much notice. I might have been sitting on the relationship or the brief for a while. How do you encourage a culture of at least a level of respect for thinking when, equally speaking, you do need to act quickly to sell?
Yeah. So time is the eternal challenge. You said the phrase culture shock before. There's certainly a lot of different elements of what that culture shock could look like for, you know, strategists coming in from other types of companies, especially agencies. But time is always the biggest culture shock. You know, I've seen brilliant strategists come into Complex or other media companies that come from the, you know, RGAs or wherever of the world. And the biggest learning curve that they often struggle with is one of time. There's just not so much time to really do the thinking that as a thinking introverted, you know, strategy person might like to do. There's just not time to do as much of it as you'd like. And I think while it's a challenge, it's also a reality of the type of game that we're trying to play and how and why it's different. So connecting this back to Complex Collective, I think part of the approach that I've taken and that the company's taken is, how do we play our own game? You know, how do we kind of break the model that is difficult of this RFP cycle and do the thinking and the research and a lot of the strategy work outside of that process for however much we can and plug it into back into the process at the right points in time? So what that actually looks like or means. So honestly, most of what brands come to us asking for is not that different. Looking across different types of brands, like different business categories, most of the asks boil down to only the same handful of different types of asks or different types of themes or points. So we're able to really anticipate what those things might look like coming in. And, you know, for me, really overseeing a lot of what the research is content-wise can make a lot of guesses as to what we need to know ahead of time and making sure that we're doing a lot of research, data collection, whatever we can do to get ahead of those things so that when we do get a certain type of ask, we've already saved as much time as possible of doing the research and really understanding a problem or the target audience or a specific area of culture where we're not starting from scratch every time. I think it really boils down to that. How can you not have to start from ground zero every pitch? Because you just don't have time to do it when these turnaround times are a handful of days and you're having to manage, you know, 30 of those requests in a given week.
Yeah. So some of the techniques that people dream about creating, it's really difficult. I've seen a lot of these launched in global agencies and they don't always last because they need a champion to promote them for a few years. And then you get a small group of people and it's probably the introverted nerds who adopt them. And then it takes years to kind of get that behavioral change. But often the techniques that people think of to help them avoid starting from scratch are things like doing their own regular custom research, having their own knowledge base, having their own online communities that they're constantly in touch with and updating themselves with or able to reach really quickly. What are some of the other techniques that you've seen across, I guess, various media organizations that actually last and are used?
It's definitely the ones that you mentioned. It's you know, I come from a family of teachers, right? And I feel like that's really informed my approach in a lot of ways of really being very like personally invested in the act of learning and teaching. And for me, I think the more that we're able to just continuously create and publish resources, both internally as a company for our own uses, as well as externally for our clients, it's really helped not only speed up the process or keep up with the pace, but it's also helped shift the perception of what a strategy team can do and what a media company can do and its relationship between, you know, the media brand and the actual brand, you know, what you can come to us for. It doesn't have to be just these quick turnaround media executions. You can come to us to actually learn things that you didn't already know about a certain area of culture or a certain audience segment. It diversifies the services offered, but it also better informs the actual process as well.
Yeah. What are some of the most interesting questions that you and your teams are seeing? Because I'd imagine, I'm going to be flippant just to push you to respond with something that's nuanced. I'd imagine a lot of briefs that reach you actually start with two simple questions or two simple demands. Make us young, make us rap.
You're close. It usually boils down to two problems we're approached with. It's make us cool and relevant with the young kids. And it's how do we achieve like mass scale? There's obviously more nuanced questions based on the brand or the business category, but it really always boils down to those two things. Mm-hmm. Honestly, there aren't that many interesting questions because it really does boil down to those two things most often. However, you know, going back to the theme of all of this is how is strategy evolving within a media company? I think in the past 12 months, especially, we were seeing aspects of this for sure. But in the past 12 months, you know, in the wake of a global pandemic, especially being based in the States, in the wake of all of the civil unrest and election year, you know, it's obviously created a pretty big shift from a consumer and a cultural standpoint of how much emphasis and focus is being put on social issues and expectations being put on brands and corporations of what is the role that you are now playing as it relates to these things. So as a result of that, it's really also changed the conversation in a lot of ways of what brands are coming to us for and what they're asking us about, which I think is a good thing, you know, A, being on the right side of history and wanting to use influence, whether it's a brand or an individual for good, but also, you know, selfishly, it creates a lot more interesting problems for us to have to stretch our brains to solve. So I think those are the types of questions that I'm seeing happen way more frequently. You know, brands coming to us saying, how do we better serve this specific community in a way that goes so far beyond, you know, selling units of X? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how can we take our history in a certain area and really push it a lot deeper as it relates to racial justice or environmental issues or whatever it is? Those are, I think, some of the most interesting questions being asked and conversations to kind of follow along with as, mm-hmm. as a strategy team. Mm-hmm.
You know what I want to do? I want to go deeper into the topic of not having to start from scratch, because it's not just you and people in the media and people who are responding to briefs at social platforms, for example, who are under immense pressure. Although you are probably under the most time pressure, because some of the organizations I've worked with, for example, they're responding to 2,000 to 3,000 briefs a year with a team of 10 to 20. And that's a lot of work. So you are definitely under pressure. But what I'm wondering is if we can try to pull out a few principles that can help other people who are also under pressure. And I'm thinking especially of people working in community management or social media management or social media strategy, content strategy. As much as people struggle with the word content, totally get it. I'm a content guy, struggle with the word still. And let's not forget that there are a lot of people who are writing creative briefs in large advertising agencies who also feel under pressure. I just think that those other groups that we called out, their faces are in that fire hose constantly, and the pressure and the time is immense. Often, not always, often they can be treated in a junior way if they're in a large agency where they're a small department. So I want to play with that a little bit more. I feel like the place to start is that if you don't want to start from scratch, you need at least two things. The first is a philosophy. What are we here to do? How do we go about it? And connected to that is, I guess, that second point. What's our way of working? And I'm going to avoid the word process here just because one person's process could be 4 or 5 steps and someone else's is a crazy diagram of things that have to happen, critical success factors and sign-offs and approvals and blah, blah, blah before some, you know, a little thing can happen. And so what's your philosophy? I know it's a fancy word, but what's your philosophy for the work that you do?
Because I'm specifically sitting within Complex, which as its own brand really does stand for very specific things. And it goes back to your question about, you know, what are the questions that brands are coming to us for and asking? I mean, if the big ones were sitting at the center of youth culture and we know what's cool with young people and that's what we're being asked for from brands, it really kind of helps have a bit more of a clear answer to that first question of what is the philosophy of what we're really trying to often achieve here? So I think at its core,
Put some words to it. Yeah, make it specific. Because here's the thing. A lot of people, you know, I'm trying to draw comparisons between your experience being in this brand where there's a known founder who also has a sensibility that people could connect themselves to, project onto, even if they don't understand exactly the words that Mark Echo might have used when starting Complex, that can disappear in an agency. You could be in a global agency that's got a founder's name on the door or multiple founder's names on the door. And then potentially, most of the global agencies are pretty good at this, to be honest, but potentially over time, you're like, I don't know what we're doing. How do we know if we're successful? What work are we trying to do? What's our point of view? And I hear these little existential pieces of angst quite often, even though it is probably written down somewhere, at least for very well-established agencies. So when you talk about Complex being a known entity, what's it known for? What do you think people are attracted to? What is the philosophy of Complex?
It's based around being ahead, or, you know, what's coming next in youth culture. And just to break down youth culture, we're talking about music, sneakers, streetwear, sports, all things cool, right? But if you're a brand that maybe isn't already recognized within that space, but you want to be, what's the process of kind of breaking down how to get them there versus a brand just kind of jumping straight in and then looking like they're trying too hard or being performative or whatever the challenge is, right? So if we know kind of the different tenets of what youth culture consists of and what Complexes look to as being really good at, you know, part of what we had done that I think really helped kind of break down some of your earlier questions of how do we save time. You know, no matter what the brand is, no matter what the business category is, we're just receiving like hundreds of briefs across a given month, right? And we had spent a lot of time actually really looking at those briefs outside of the process when we actually have time to think about what, like, who's asking us this and what are they asking? Why are they asking us this? And trying to start to connect the dots and draw patterns between what we're being asked and by who and why. And, you know, we had done that over the course of a 3-month period, I want to say. We looked at well over 100 briefs, right? And we started to categorize everything that I'm saying. And when it boiled down to it, there was really only, I want to say, 12 to 14 subsets of what that question was of, like, how can you help us become more culturally relevant? You know, it boiled down to more like vertical base asks, like plug us into music, plug us into sports. Sometimes it was more of an audience-based ask, like Gen Z, millennials, specific audience segment. We started to categorize these things. And as I said, these categories were extremely finite despite the huge volume of work we were fielding. The types, subsets of asks were pretty small, honestly.
Yeah. I just want to highlight that point,
though.
As we're exploring the idea of not having to start from scratch, sitting down and analyzing the types of questions, putting them into categories so that you're aware of what's coming in is a way to not start from scratch, so that you know what muscles you need to build, what behaviors, techniques, access to resources and people you might need to have on standby or full time so that you can respond to things quickly. So I just wanted to highlight that point. Continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the course of a quarter, if you're asked, you know, tell us more about Gen Z or what's the best platform to post on and at what time, like you hear the same types of questions over and over again. And if you're only ever feeling them when you're within the cycle of the RFP, when you only have 48 hours and you're asking those questions internally to get the answers every time, you're kind of fighting a losing game. You're always going to be running in the hamster wheel and never kind of taking the time to stop and step outside that process and really think about what are we doing and how do we find those efficiencies. So I think finding however you can, stepping outside the process and really doing some meta-analysis of like, what are we actually doing here? And why do we keep hearing these same questions? How about we just get the one answer and every time it comes up, it's already, you know, in the can.
Yep.
I think is super important.
Okay. So the philosophy is basically about being and discovering what's next in youth culture through various topics, including sneakers, music, and sports. The main ask from clients or agencies representing clients is plug us in. Is there a way of working that is relatively consistent? And I'm talking big categories here, a way of working that is relatively consistent that you would expect to do and to see with your team, whether they had 24 hours, 72 hours, or a week to respond to a brief. What would you expect to see happen?
Yeah, I mean, the analogy is I know I'm using the dirty word that you said not to use. The process is an accordion. The things that need to get done, whether it's a 24-hour period or a 72-hour period or a two-week period, it's the same. But I think understanding what each part of that process is and how you can bend and stretch it or compress it, I think is really key because it helps you understand, like, if I need to get all this done in 48 hours, here's how we're going to get it done. Or if we actually have time, here's where we're going to plus up certain things. So I'll give an example. If we have 48 hours, I can tell you right off the bat, the things that we're probably not going to have a whole lot of time for is research, as one example, right? So I think that's a good indicator of, okay, we need to immediately go and, you know, what are the things we need to understand and what are the resources we already have on hand? We'll just pick those things up, kind of quickly go through them. How does that inform, you know, the creative brief or the brainstorm discussion as it's happening, just so we can cut out, you know, however many hours of days of work there, but not lose the research. Versus if we have time, research is one of those things that we can really plus up. Okay, you know, great. We have an extra 2 or 3 days in the process. How are we actually going to use this time in a smart way to really dive deeper in the ways that we wish we could on every project and really not waste that time? So it always comes back to time. It's when we don't have the time, how can we make sure that we're not actually throwing away pieces of the process, that they're still happening, but yep, just contracted, versus when we have the time, let's make sure we're actually valuing it and not wasting it.
What kind of research are you most likely to do? Are you interviewing people? Are you texting people? Are you looking at desk research, trend reports? What are you looking at?
It's a wide range. I mean, part of the reason that Complex Collective even exists is it came out of having this problem and needing a real solution for it, because it didn't exist when I started at Complex. And then after seeing all the problems that we're talking about now, there's the light bulb moment of like, man, what are we going to do? How are we going to fix this for ourselves? And, you know, from that, for one of many reasons, Complex Collective was born, and it's helped tremendously. So even just having kind of built an internal engine where we have a lot of our own research that we're doing for ourselves. We have a much better kind of tool and process on our own first party data as a media company that we are able to look at in a more structured way has helped tremendously. The team's big on Slack. You know, we have a Slack channel of just like dump all the interesting things that you're seeing across the internet, third party research, all that stuff. And it's a good conversation starter within the team to be seeing and talking about a lot of different things.
Okay.
Another big thing too that's super helpful being in a media company that you don't necessarily have within an agency is, it goes back to your question about, you know, the editorial team. When there is that barrier up of that separation of church and state, it's really doing a disservice to the full power that a media company could have, especially in how it collaborates with the strategy team, because there's such a wealth of knowledge. The writers, the editors, the journalists, like, they're the people who are on the ground seeing and really living and breathing these different areas of the world or culture, and they understand so much. So within Complex, you know, if we're getting an ask about, hey, make us cool, plug us into music, we have a whole editorial staff that's dedicated to music. All they do all day is think about music, write about music, talk to artists, talk to music fans. Like, even an hour-long conversation with them will be so enlightening in a way that if you were, you know, kind of sitting at your desk being like, man, where do I start? What do I need to Google? Like, it just, it saves so much time to have those people in-house and just have these quick, easy conversations.
Yeah, so people is a big part of being able to not have to start from scratch every time you receive a brief. We've talked about philosophy, generally a way of working, which involves some kind of research. And I'd imagine that with most responses, you're not necessarily going in with some big new brand strategy reveal or even necessarily redefining the problem. From what I've seen in most media responses is, you know, a summary of quote unquote insights or data that are connected to the publisher and the audience. And then there could be almost like a strategy slash creative campaign slash platform idea all merged as a response.
Yep.
And then we get into where it's going to appear, how many people it might reach, and how much it's going to cost. And here's a deal, by the way. So I've sort of seen that pattern. Are your responses any different to that?
It's similar in a lot of ways, but again, in the way that the company's diversified, the types of things that we're pitching and what stage that the brand is at in their planning process, sometimes that changes.
Yep.
I'd say that the vast majority or average is pretty similar to what you said. It's like, I feel like our way of working is almost like this trash compactor where we're just crushing all the parts of the process and what we're actually pitching and what a brand is buying all into one.
Yep. Yep. And that's, yeah, that stuff's really hard to change. Despite all the idealism, there's still a practical reality that you are responding to often a media agency, not always a media agency, but often a media agency who might have sent the brief to tens of different publishers. I'm sure there are organizations like yours where you might get, you know, maybe not competing with as many because you offer something that's relatively difficult to access, but your response is often one of tens to possibly, no offense, like a relatively junior media planner or whatnot. And so that can be, there's no real need for you to kind of reinvent or redefine what the problem is and go on this massive research exploration. It's about trying to get something that sticks in that person's mind so they share it with their boss and that they share it with the client and that potentially a deal can happen. And it's really easy to over-engineer and fuss over these things with idealism, which is beautiful and poetic and lovely, but that it might actually get in the way of the sale. So not starting from scratch, people really important. Now, you talked about how your editorial team are obviously connected to the zeitgeist. And you've talked about having an intelligence engine and essentially like a pool of intelligence through your team and that they're able to access each other through Slack, etc. When you're hiring people for the strategy team, how connected to the zeitgeist or the zeitgeist do they have to be?
Yeah, man, you've asked the million-dollar question of the hiring process. Like, of all the things to consider, I personally think that that is one of the most challenging things because there's this spectrum of thinking about strategy. There's this spectrum of people who are more classically trained in strategy. I'm doing air quotes. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have super like culturally attuned, right? I've seen people working within a media company who really understand strategy and have, they know the frameworks, they know the process, they've worked for all these amazing agencies, but then they come in and maybe they're not super tapped into culture, or maybe they have that big culture shock of time of how long do I have to get this done? Like, how is that possible? And that's a huge learning curve. And that's when you don't have time to also have to like learn that stuff on top of it. It's really challenging. And the flip side is I've seen people come in who are super tapped into culture, perhaps even never worked a strategy job within another media company or agency or brand, but perhaps they've worked in the music industry or they've founded their own streetwear label and they really understand what makes culture tick or these different pockets of youth culture. And, you know, that's such a wealth of knowledge that's really hard to teach somebody unless they're actually living and breathing it. So
yeah,
the answer to your question is, I feel like when it's time for hiring, we're on like this unicorn hunt of who falls squarely in between those two things, which is really challenging. So oftentimes you're having to make decisions of, let's hire somebody who has a bit more towards the strategy side and a bit less on the culturally kind of attuned side, but we need to kind of, we're going into it with a plan of here's how we're going to get them up to speed. Yep. Or the flip side of that scenario.
Yeah, there are nuances that, you know, to use Echo as an example, and I'm just going to give the example without any particular judgment. I ran a rap / hip hop magazine back in the day, and Echo went on a global domination spree. Mark Echo, relatively well-known and respected in the US. You know, we didn't have the internet in the way that we have it now back then in Australia. I'm talking 20 plus years ago. And so really the first time I encountered Mark Echo in a meaningful way was, I think he did the illustration for Lyricist Lounge, this double album. Was it on Raucous Records? Anyways, it's an awesome album. I still played on the radio show all the time. Had a lot of my favorite underground, mostly New York rappers from memory. I could be getting all of this sort of stuff wrong. You know, it's early in the career of Mos Def, and Talib Kweli and people like that, for example. Now, the company that got the access to the Echo license in Australia, from memory, was like a skateboard company. And what they would do is they'd try to come into like the underground hip hop scene through breakdancing mats with a big Echo logo. They'd pay breakers maybe $50 up to $200. Maybe they started to pay them a little bit better, but it was not a lot of money. But every time we, in kind of like the little industry, I'm using air quotes now, industry, we dealt with them, they were lovely, but they were skating people. And so it would always make us a little bit wary. And that's a nuance that unless you're in a subculture, you're just not going to quite understand. Because the nuance there is like, how real is this Echo company if in Australia they're being represented by a skateboard company? And back then, those two things were very separate. There started to become an overlap after the time of the Tony Hawk game and Mark Echo and the X Games and all these things. There started to be this opening up, but when you're in it, really different. And, you know, one wrong word said to a 21-year-old, 22-year-old who thinks they know everything about rare vinyl, it can, you know, not end a relationship, but it can make people more wary, right? And you can't learn that necessarily unless you're living it.
Right. Yeah. I'm also a good example of it. Like, I am not classically trained, however we want to define that. Like, I'm not a classically trained strategist. I've never worked at an agency. I've not worked in-house for a brand. Like, my whole background's in music. My parents are music teachers. I had co-founded a music organization, went to school for music, like everything music. So, you know, I see it in myself of how I am thinking through other people or how I might not judge them, but judge them. And like, well, why am I feeling this way about this person? Because when I look at myself, like, this has been my experience. You know, I really challenge myself in thinking through like, what exactly does this person have or what are they maybe missing? And what does the team and the company really need? And can really thoroughly assessing the both sides of that spectrum.
What does classically trained mean? I never heard it until I moved to the US and then I was running strategy teams and people would apologize to me about not being classically trained. And I'm like, what, you didn't study the classics at Oxford or Cambridge? Is that what you're talking about? So you used it. What does it mean? What's classically trained, Nick?
Yeah, so let's talk about it. I say it in the way that I kind of almost just explained it. I didn't go to school for strategy, marketing, business. I have not worked at an agency or in-house at a brand. That's the way that I'm phrasing it. You know, I have a degree that says I know how to do music good. On paper, I've started a company as like a co-founder entrepreneur in the music space. Like, these are things that don't have strategy or anything attached to it on paper. But, you know, I think because that's been my background, I think in moments of not imposter syndrome, I'm able to recognize what makes me and my background uncommon is what makes me kind of good and unique in a way that others don't have. And that's certainly the advice that I give to others who have asked me similar things. But I think the real key here, and Vic Pinheiro, who I know you know, we had done a whole talk about this about a year ago, just the idea of transferable skills, I feel like is so key because it is true to your question that so many strategists don't have classically trained backgrounds, and like, who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. If you know how to think and creatively solve problems and have some base level things, I think that's what really matters. And I think if you also know what your background is, even if it is different, and how those skills transfer to different contexts, like, that's a pretty unstoppable force.
Like, if you can think and you can write, and if you see strategy largely as thinking and writing, everybody's welcome to disagree with that. I just think it's the easiest way to see through this. That's what it is. I still don't know what a classically trained planner is. Like, I think it's some weird internalized embarrassment that perhaps people didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge. And it's, I trace it back to Oxford and Cambridge. I trace it back to this English tick that I now hear around America. This apologetic, well, I don't have an English accent, I'm not English. And by the way, if your friends are listening to this, some of them might think I'm English, I'm Australian. Just saying that. What? Also, hi, Vic. And the thing is that it's writing and thinking, so that you could look at your music background, write a clean sentence that brings together a particular genre and an interesting observation about that genre in a sentence. And that sentence is going to carry more weight than a lot of what you see in 100-slide strategy documents that don't have the discipline to think and write. They're collecting information, they're reporting numbers, and then there's some kind of, I don't know, creative idea with 50 things you could choose, dear client, but we don't have an opinion about it, but do you like any of them? And by the way, here's how much it's going to cost. Just having 5 to 10 clean sentences in a presentation or in a document or on a page, that's the work of strategy at the heart of it. And yes, you could be an expert in qualitative research. You could be an expert in behavioral economics or quantitative research, be great at numbers, all that sort of stuff. And it's really important. And those people are incredible. Think and write. That's where it starts. And it's beautiful to be classically untrained, I think. Just saying.
I'm biased, but I agree.
But on this, and let's round this conversation out. I've been taking notes. To not start from scratch, it does help to have a few techniques, a few pieces of jargon, because they're going to happen, a few pieces of jargon that a team understands, and possibly a few frameworks where we're not necessarily dogmatic with either or any of those things, that they're just tools for us to use, the words, the frameworks, the techniques. We use them, we practice them, and sometimes we introduce new things so that we're coming up with fresh ideas and keeping ourselves fresh. Do you have a couple of techniques, tools, or frameworks that you use most?
Yes, but with a twist. All right, let's start with the basics, right? We've got our classic, who's your target audience, problem, insight, edge strategy, right? So that's a baseline, right, of what we can use. But I think this goes back to one of the points that you made earlier about the compressing of what's actually the work being done and what's being pitched. I think there's some tweaks to that. Oftentimes, when we're getting briefed as a media company, any media company, right, you're probably coming in pretty late in the assembly line. The brands internally have touched it. Creative agencies probably touched it. Media agencies touched it. You know, a lot of that work to some degree has already been done. And by the time the brief comes to you, a lot of that stuff is already spelled out. So I think as a media company, you have to think about, what do you know better than they know? Like,
yep.
And especially when you don't have time to do the research, like, you probably don't understand their brand better than they understand their brand. You probably don't understand their core business challenges better than they understand it. But there are things that you do know better than them, because as a media company, you are the audience, you are the platforms. And in the specific example of like a complex, you are the areas and pockets of culture. So I think that's the opportunity to find, how can you start to plug those extra little bits that you do know better into that, even things as basic as that, you know, base level problem, insight, edge strategy. You know, that's, I think, the opportunity is to kind of tweak what's already been given to you in ways that will still not take a lot of time, but give them those aha moments as it relates to the target audience and those insights. But I think also when it comes to that edge, you're no longer talking about one brand. You're also talking about the media company's brand. And I think that's an opportunity to just show the synergies of what each brand stands for. What are those unique and differentiated things on both sides? But where is that overlap? I think that's how you start getting to something that's really unique within a very limited, compressed amount of time, but still comes across as like, that's a great strategy that led to this great creative. Like, let's do this together.
Yeah. I'm yipping because sales teams often seem a bit embarrassed about the thing that a media company is best at. And having worked with a few different organizations without naming them, you know, there's sort of been this discussion about like, we know this one audience really, really well. You know, top three in the world, we are at knowing this audience. I'm talking like Yoda now. You know, we're top three in the world at knowing this audience. And yet the sales team's gone in a little bit embarrassed by that. And they want to sell some kind of response for an audience that you've barely ever dealt with, and that's going to drain weeks maybe from the team's time. Now, that stuff is important at times, but often what happens is it prevents a really strong philosophy and point of view within the strategy team, so that maybe for a year, they're like, you know what, we want to be the best in the world at this one thing, and we're going to nail it. By knowing that, and by all of us knowing that, we're going to be able to work quicker and better. And we're going to have deeper expertise on that. And maybe we'll open things up every now and then. But if there's a constant arm wrestle between a sales team saying, yeah, that one thing's cool, but also, you know, we want to sell, you know, sneakers to horses right now. Does anybody know anything about horses? And you're like, why are we doing horses? Okay, it's cats. It's cats this time, guys. Anybody got anything on cats? I'm just going to throw some stuff at the wall and see if we can get this sale. It can really wear out a group of people who think, you know, who are introverted and who don't just exist in that extroverted energy. And so that's why I was yepping. It's sort of not just having a framework or two, technique, piece of jargon available to you, it's also being relatively strong in your main focus, because otherwise you are literally starting from scratch anytime a brief comes in, right?
Yeah. So I think there's a way to flip this, because I think a lot of this discussion has been talking about the lack of time, or we as a media company only talk about XYZ things and not these other things as problems, but I think there's, or challenges, but I think there's a flip perspective on it, which is the lack of time can be seen as a positive in a way, because the way that like young people and the way that culture moves is at a blistering pace. So if you are spending 3 months, 6 months, whatever, trying to get to like, what are we going to do? You've already missed that amount of time of opportunity for a brand to really participate in what the conversation is on social, or how culture is changing, and what are the moments, and like, how do we as a brand participate in these things? So I think in a way it's a challenge, but the flip side is it allows us to work with brands as the world is changing and happening in really smart ways that honestly keeps brands relevant. Because for brands that are just moving at a snail's pace, that's a uphill battle in today's world.
Yep. All right. Last question. For somebody who is doing strategy work in a media company, who is on the receiving end of a fire hose, who might be a bit introverted, who might not like conflict, who is dealing with very extroverted, dominating salespeople who are great at selling, but that they feel a bit under the thumb quite often. What do you think is the single most useful thing that they could do to start, not starting from scratch? We've listed, you know, maybe 10 or so, right? What do you think is the single most important thing that they could do, the place to start, to not start from scratch in the future?
To me, it's building those internal resources. It's understanding what are the questions that were asked over and over and over again, and how do we just answer them once, get ahead of it, and how do we create something that just answers it one time, and that's what we can turn to every time. It will save so much time for the time challenge, but I think to your point about, you know, sometimes the dynamics between sales and strategy, extroverts and introverts, as somebody who is very introverted, and when I had initially come into that system, I personally struggled with how do I force myself to speak up and, you know, give certain types of feedback in ways that feel extremely uncomfortable. But I think for me, and now having those internal education tools that I have at my disposal, or I may have even created myself, I feel much better, A, educated. That helps give me as an introverted person confidence to kind of jump in and speak up and keep things on track. But B, you know, kind of going back to the point about my parents being teachers and how it's really informed my personal process, I think the more that I'm able to just think about every interaction with one or a group of human beings is just like a teaching moment. Like I can teach somebody something that they didn't know before and give them that aha moment that makes them kind of grateful to me and, you know, us doing a better job or collaborating together, and want more of that, I think has also really helped me in those situations or in those interactions.
Yeah.
So I think those are two big things that come to mind.
And that second one is it's a it's a bit of spiritual maturity there. It can take us some time to learn. And then once we settle into it, it's quite beautiful. In some corporate environments, other powerful people can be suspicious of the person who is a coach like object, who is into teachable moments rather than bossing and being powerful. So there can be a sense of danger with being that vulnerable, gentle spirit in some corporate environments. I want to point that out. Nick, where can people find you on the internet?
LinkedIn is cool. I have a website with a very vain URL of nicksusi.com. Find me on Instagram, find me on Twitter. It's just my name.
Beautiful. Nick Susi, Head of Strategy at Complex Collective. Thank you so much for joining me from Jerusalem today. Best wishes with, these are my words, I'm going to say it, wrangling that sales team. No, I'm joking. Like you, we need that energy. You know, I mean, they close the deals, they bring the money and you need it. But, you know, may you continue to work out how to work together well and create an environment for the people who are a bit more introverted and who do think and probably struggle to not think to also flourish, because being in the sort of combination of subcultures you're in, I'm sure would be a lot of people's career dreams. So anyway, thank you for joining me on Sweater today, Nick.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Peace.